We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So, get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.
Okay, well, here we are for the next episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone.
And once again, I'm not, but I am Brooke Dougherty.
Your loss.
My loss.
So we are thrilled to have a special guest today. This is a person that anybody who grew up or raised kids, I think it's west of Temescal and east of
PCH.
Anywhere in that area and sent their kids to public schools, to Marquez, will know the guest we have here today. He is a legend, and we are thrilled to have him with us. We have Jeff Lantos here today.
Hey, good to be here.
Can you believe it? Mr. Lantos.
Mr. Lantos.
Mr. L or Sire.
Yeah. Sire Lantos, yes.
He's been called other things, but that's not
this is
on
the
this
man,
podcast.
This is the man that allowed my daughter to play Benjamin Franklin in tap shoes.
Wow.
Tap shoes.
And two of my daughters went through all of his historical musicals, and they still talk about it, and it's changed them for the better. No doubt. And I think any parent that had a kid at Marquez for the last 20 years will remember him fondly.
And I know my kid right now still manages to be able to talk about politics with a little bit more intelligence than her peers, and I attribute it all to fifth grade history.
So for those of you that don't know or don't remember, Mr. Lantos started at Marquez, what, about 20 years ago?
1994.
Okay, so pretty close. And he created a series of historical musicals. Is that what we would call them?
Yes, performing history, we call it.
Okay. I remember one was about Ben Franklin. One was about the Ben Franklin and the Constitutional Convention.
That's right. He was one of the delegates, the oldest delegate.
Miracle in Philadelphia.
Right. And then there was one that was Water and Power about the
Industrial Revolution and the cotton mills of Lowell, Massachusetts.
And I forget, what was the third?
And the second one is Hello, Louisiana, about the Lewis and Clark Expedition and the trip by the Corps of Discovery across the continent.
And they were delightful. Students in the fifth grade all participated. Jeff wrote songs and wrote script, and they all learned the music. He played piano, as I recall.
I played the piano. I should add that Bill Augustine, my piano teacher, wrote the music. I wrote the lyrics and the librettos.
Okay.
Bill Augustine.
Stand corrected.
Did the toe-tapping melodies.
And they were fantastic, and kids still know them today. So this is long before the advent of Hamilton, but I think of Jeff Lantos as a precursor to Hamilton and all the notoriety that it's gotten.
But how did he get there?
That's what we're here to find out about. So,
too many blank faces when teaching the Constitution.
No. You went to Brown, right?
I did.
And were you a history major?
I was. I was lucky to study with three Pulitzer Prize winners, including Gordon Wood, who has a new book out on Jefferson and Adams.
And how did you get from...
Well, wait.
What?
You digress, I think.
No, I was digressing.
Yeah. Don't we want to go back a little earlier and find out before Brown?
That's what I was saying. How did you get from three to Brown?
Okay.
Or who?
There you go.
You take it. You're the backstory interviewer.
I'm the back alley interviewer.
Yeah.
So, as Brooke just said, how did you get to Brown? Where'd you grow up? What'd you do? Tell us about your family a little bit.
I grew up in western Pennsylvania, a down at the Heels mill town right now called Johnstown, Pennsylvania. 25% unemployment and an opioid epidemic right now. But in those days, it was a steel and coal town. And then I went to public school there. And
what did your parents do?
My father is a cardiologist, which was it's a good place to be a cardiologist, where half the population has black lung.
Ooh.
Not for them, but for him.
Plenty of business.
Right.
Or a pulmonologist probably also does well there, too.
Yes, exactly.
And your mom?
My mom's from Boston and couldn't believe that she had been dragged to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which she never recovered from. So she made sure that we always got to New York to see shows, and we got foreign languages, and we went to museums, because we were so deprived in Johnstown of any cultural activities.
Siblings?
Three siblings, all younger. Two of them are now doctors, and one's a teacher.
It doesn't sound like the kind of place that you would expect someone to grow from and be someone who would create a musical, historical plays. There must have been something there going on that other than just steel workers and black lung disease that inspired you.
Well, as I said, my mother made sure to that we had we were exposed to all kinds of cultural activities. She was the motivating force. But my dad also liked Broadway shows. And, you know, we would take the train into New York, the Broadway Limited. And I remember I drove in high school with three friends to see Hair when it just opened on Broadway.
And when
revolutionary
you used to have some.
And when I used to have some, yes. So I remember we walked into a ticket agency, and the guy said, we had one guy on crutches from a football injury. He was the quarterback on the football team, and he had broken his leg. So he said, what do you guys want, four tickets and with one on the aisle for the guy with the crutches? And we said, yes, $15 a piece. That's what we paid for tickets to Hair.
That was a lot then.
That was. That was 1969.
Was there any other cultural opportunities in Johnstown, Pennsylvania?
There was a symphony, and I had an uncle who had a bookstore. But that was about, high school musicals.
Oh.
We had a wonderful drama teacher in high school. I still remember the three musicals I was in. That was one of the highlights of my high school career, besides playing on the basketball team. I can still sing all the lyrics from Camelot, Hello Dolly, and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
But can you dunk a basketball?
No.
What was your major in? Did you do any musicals in college?
I took playwriting with a novelist named Bill Goyen, whose wife was Doris Roberts, who was an actress on a Broadway and television shows, including Angie and Everyone Loves Raymond.
Oh.
So he and Doris were the reason I came out to L.A.
Wow.
My senior year, I had Bill Goyen for a playwriting class, and he said, you know, you ought to come out to L.A. And
be a teacher.
Yeah, and go to Marquez Elementary.
How did you end up coming out of this? It sounds like your mom was a bit of a Brahmin.
I wouldn't say Brahmin, but she had a college education.
Okay, and, so how did you get?
She read to us every night, and
she was a homemaker.
Yes.
So you came out here to be an actor?
No,
a writer.
A writer, yes. And I ended up at the American Film Institute in the screenwriting program, and then I came out and became a staff writer for American Film Magazine, which was their in-house organ. And then I switched over to Movie Line Magazine. So I was doing 3,000-word profiles of actors, actresses, directors. And I did that for 13 years.
Sort of like we're doing with teachers right here and now, only we're not limited to 3,000 words.
That's right.
How did you end up at Marquez?
That's a interesting story. Well, let's say at the age of 32, I got married, and at the time, I was still writing freelance and pitching projects, which, you know, would always go to about 90%, and then it would fall apart. And after 5 years of that, I said, okay, I can't take this anymore. Mm.
So when you first came out here, you were writing and pitching
right.
stories, plays, screenplays.
Right. Yes, and anything. then essays. Mm-hmm. I did 13 years at Movie Line writing 3,000 word profiles.
And was that not satisfying? Or?
Oh, it was great, but it wasn't regular. That was the thing. 5-6 a year.
It wasn't a living.
It wasn't a living. So I thought, okay, what can I do that I can be creative? I'll have time to write. I'll have summers off. I'll get health insurance.
Yeah. So, and Christmas vacation and Easter vacation and all that stuff.
And at the time, there was a huge teacher shortage. So I didn't even student teach. I just went right from my program into the classroom. I mean, that's how desperate people were, especially for men in elementary school.
Or?
Oh, I got a teaching degree. I went to Cal State LA. Mm-hmm. I got a credential, 18 months at night. But I was I had been thrown into a classroom before I got my credential.
At Marquez?
No. I was at the Open Magnet School, which was actually the very first school to be adopted by Apple. This was in the mid-80s. Apple had just invented the desktop, and Alan Kay, who was their resident visionary, that was his job title, by the way, visionary, came to the Open School and said, would you like to pilot a program with our new boxy desktops, and we'll make you special desks so that you can slide the computer underneath a glass top so the kids would be able to write on a flat desk while looking at the computer through the glass. And those were the days when Apple would give you stuff. Mm. So they completely, you know, outfitted the school. And, of course, they were very smart because they ended up with many, many children and teachers continuing to be loyal to the Apple brand. Yeah. But that's when that's when computers in the classroom began. It was at the Open Magnet School. And then from there I went to Hancock Park Elementary on Fairfax. And in 1992 I had a class where 11 languages were spoken in one self-contained class. It was remarkable. I couldn't believe it. So I asked a friend of mine who made commercials to come in and shoot a video of one day in my classroom, because I said, you can't believe this. What's going on here? And I didn't know you need to get permission to shoot on campus. I just blew everything up. I just brought a crew in. No one knew what I was doing. The guy shot for 6 hours. We cut it down to a 30-minute video. We ended up selling it to UC Berkeley, their educational division. And somehow, a copy of that video got in the hands of Ruth Mills, mm-hmm. who's a parent in the Palisades.
An alpha mom.
and then became a teacher at Pali High, teaching Spanish.
Yes. And she had kids at Marquez. And they needed a new fifth grade teacher. So they saw this video. And so when I came over, I didn't even have to interview. People had seen me in the classroom already. So they said, you can have the job if you want it.
Was that after Marquez had become a charter school, or was that before?
Right after.
So that's where the parents now were able to assert themselves.
Yes. And I remember I didn't know where Marquez was, and I ended up going to Pali Elementary thinking that was Marquez. It was so far out there.
So how many years were you at Marquez before you, or what inspired you to get the idea to do the musicals?
So after 2 years at Marquez, where I was teaching American history, I saw too many blank faces during my lectures on the Constitutional Convention, and I thought, you know, there's a dramatic component, a huge dramatic component here. It's one room, it's one set, it's 55 people arguing for 5 months. The conflict is built in. One set rolls for 30 people, at least, for an entire class. Why not act this out? Because you have Madison's account of what was said. So if you read that, there's your dialogue. So many of the lines and phrases in the script are taken right from Madison's primary source notes.
And then you have all the states in one song and all the
yes,
capitals in.
It takes about 2 years to get the script to where I'm happy with it. So what'll happen is we'll do a first year performance. It'll be like a workshop, and I'll realize what the kids are getting because I'll talk to them afterwards, quiz them, see what they're not getting, and then I'll tweak it. I'll go back to Bill and say, hey, Bill, we need a song on the 13 colonies. Or, Bill, we need a song called I'm Going to Write That Constitution, because the kids were mixing up the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution, as so many adults do today.
And so you saw this initially as just a way to help educate the kids in a way that they'd find interesting.
It started as a GATE program. GATE is gifted and talented education. So this was considered higher level thinking, and it was the initial impulse was, okay, let's give it to the smart kids because we're not sure if the not smart kids can do this. So we did it with one class of GATE kids in 96, but then all the other parents saw it and said, hey, we want this for our kids too. And luckily, I had a colleague, Michelle Kahn, who was 100% on board with the program. It's not easy finding teachers who are willing to put on a musical in fifth grade. It's ambitious. It's an ambitious undertaking. And most teachers don't feel they have the chops to do it and don't want to do it. In fact, when Michelle interviewed at Marquez, a bunch of other teachers went up to her and said, oh, you don't want to work with Lantos. All he does is play the piano all day. You won't be able to teach. Michelle told me that later. But we've had a beautiful relationship. She's I call her my second wife.
And you guys had adjacent classrooms.
We had adjacent classrooms, and I have a piano in my room. So every morning, her kids would come over. We'd have 60 kids singing not only the songs from the shows, but also standards. For instance, today I was up at school, and the kids said, can we sing Fly Me to the Moon? And so we do songs from the Great American Songbook, which I think is the great American art form, just like the French have the Impressionists and the Russians have their novelists. Those songs from Gershwin, Berlin, Porter, those are the American art form that's going to last. Well, they already have lasted.
Isn't it true that when you learn through singing, that you're learning through a different part of your brain?
Absolutely. It imprints on the brain. You know, musical instruments have been found at every archaeological site of every civilization. Music is a vital part of living. Nietzsche said that life without music would not be worth living. And it's an incredibly underused teaching tool. You know, it's right there. It's right there. And we teach kindergarten kids songs. That's how they learn the Incy Wincy Spider and the alphabet. And then it's, for some reason, it's dropped. And it's really an underutilized teaching tool. And I think every classroom should have a piano in it.
It's weird because the lyrics to the songs from your shows, when my daughter went on to 8th grade U.S. history and then again 11th grade U.S. history, and then again college something U.S. history, she might not have remembered anything else about the plays, but she could still, at age 27, sing you every single one of those songs, and there's valuable information in them.
Yeah, I try to shoehorn as much content as possible into the lyrics so the kids don't even realize how much they're learning. I call it stealth learning. But you're right. You go on a field trip with kids, they're singing these rap songs or Hamilton songs from memory. You know, they've never seen the script.
Well, you were like Hamilton before there was Hamilton.
Yeah, in fact, when Barack Obama saw Hamilton, he did an interview later with Marilynne Robinson, and he said, why isn't history taught like this in every school? Mm-hmm. So I wrote to the White House, and I said, it is. You should come out to Marquez and see a show. And somebody from the White House actually called me and said, we got your letter. You know, I've never gotten a call back. I usually get those form letters. We got your letter. The president would love to attend, but he's busy, but to keep up the good work. So maybe now he could come out and see it since he's not so busy.
Yeah, but then he wouldn't be the president.
Well, he's the president we wish we had.
Yeah. I think that speaks for most of us, although some may disagree, but not in this neighborhood.
So, when did you? I thought you retired at some point. Is that?
Wait, you're skipping up to retirement?
No, no. Well, you go. Go ahead.
Wait, you're like.
Well, let me take you through the beginning. Okay. So after we did Miracle in Philadelphia, it was such a wonderful experience for everybody. I thought, well, why stop with one? And what are the three seminal events in early American history? They are the creating of the country, which you do with the Constitution, then doubling the size of the country, which you do with the Louisiana Purchase. Then you change the way people work, from the farms to the factories. No longer ruled by the sun, now we're ruled by the punch clock. So that's the narrative thread.
Well, but I mean, you could have, I mean, you've done incredible work, but there were other events you could have also,
oh sure,
written about. I mean, the Revolution or the Civil War,
Miracle
or
Philadelphia
things like
that. Miracle
in
Philadelphia
is about
the Revolution, no?
No, not really.
I could have written other things, but I knew that 1776 had already been written about the Declaration of Independence.
And you did write another one. There is another one.
I have other shows, but my curriculum is supposed to end at 1840. So I teach from Jamestown to the Industrial Revolution, so I don't get to the Civil War.
Got it. Okay. And so you're doing this, the original one, and people are responding positively, and then... What, you just say, okay, it's time to branch out and move on, do something else, come up with another one?
Yes. And here's the thing, Steve. You have to come up with a subject that has 30 parts, because every kid in the class has to have a role.
Even if it's a small role.
Even if it's a small role. So, and the Industrial Revolution is perfect because it's a girl power show. It's very rare to have stories in history where the leading characters are women, or in this case, teenage girls who are working in the cotton mills. So it's a real girl power show.
Girl forward.
Girl forward. They fight for the right. They fight for the 10-hour workday. They fight against pay cuts. They lobby their legislators. They speak in public for the first time. And then they use the money to go to college, which was... There was only one college that took women, Oberlin.
Hmm.
I don't remember, because my kids are now in their 30s, so I don't remember them that well. But how did you come up with a dialogue for the Louisiana Purchase? You explained how you had it for the Constitutional Convention from Madison. But everything else, I assume... Louisiana Purchase and Water and Power, you had to write it from scratch, right?
Well, you'd be surprised. Lewis and Clark both kept journals.
Okay.
So those are published.
Uh-huh.
Regarding the Industrial Revolution, the girls working in the cotton mill started their own magazine called the Lowell Offering. So a lot of the dialogue in that show was taken from articles that the girls wrote about working in the mills.
And I don't think I ever was aware that Bill Augustine existed, but he sounds like, I don't know, I hate to use the word, but kind of a musical genius. I mean, you say, write me songs for, 20 songs for this play I have, and here's the idea, write me a song. Is that the way he did it?
Bill's phenomenal. Yeah. He's like Richard Rodgers. Hammerstein used to say that I would spend 3 weeks on a lyric, I'd give it to Dick Rogers, he'd come up with a melody in 15 minutes. That's the way I felt.
So you guys were like Rogers and Hammerstein?
Well, I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
Andy Bill's a
jazz pianist, so the score is, it's kind of like Multiplication Rock. Do you remember those CDs from Bob Dereau and Jack Shelton? They did these great educational songs. They called it rock, but it was really jazz. And that's what Bill writes.
And then your piano skills are good enough that you could play anything that he wrote.
Yeah. And he was my teacher, so if I wasn't playing it well, he would let me know.
And he'd have the dads that played instruments come and be part
of
the band.
We've had some of the finest bands in the Palisades. We've had the harpist from the LA Philharmonic, Lou Ann Neal. We have Charlie Bicharette, who's one of the top studio musicians.
You had my husband from the Weasels.
We had your husband from the Weasels. We had Nina Efterhoff, who's another studio musician. Jeff Feynman, who's a drummer, and his son, Stefan, is also a drummer who opened for Coldplay at the Rose Bowl. So Steve Bartek, who writes for Oingo Boingo, these guys keep coming back. I mean, Charlie was just here last week. His kid graduated 17 years ago, and he's still coming in to jam with me during the shows. It's a thrill for me to play with these pros.
So then what happened?
Well, wait a second. You always tend to skip ahead, and I tend to bring you back.
We've got another show.
So we got Lewis and Clark. And
that was 98.
That's a couple years after
96 for Miracle, 98 for Lewis and Clark, and then I wrote Water and Power in 2000. We did our first show in 2000.
So
for 17 years we've been doing three.
While this is going on, you are teaching during the day, and at nighttime and on weekends you're writing your scripts.
And summers.
Well, you had summers off, so what else did you have to do?
Right. And as I say, they would be continually tweaked over the years.
And as I recall, they would do all three plays during a school year.
Yes. We had a wonderful principal who recognized the value of the program and gave us 90 minutes every Thursday morning to rehearse. So it was part of the curriculum, as it should be. Because
who was that principal?
Jackie Oda.
Oh, yeah.
Jackie was
the
one.
She was amazing.
She was great.
In the two classes, there would be two casts. So there'd be two Jeffersons and two Washingtons and two Madisons. So there was, I wouldn't say there was a lot of backstabbing for the parts, but there were auditions, and it was, you know, I think you were really careful about making sure that everybody got a fair shot.
Well, that's the nice thing about having three shows, is if you don't get the part you want in the first or the second show, you know that you'll probably get the part you want in the third show. So it's much better than just doing one show, because then I become an equal opportunity employer. And by the way, Brooke, some years we've had four casts, because there were four fifth grades for a long, long time.
And you keep them all straight, theoretically.
Well, okay. I won't comment on that.
The key was we had four teachers who all bought into the program. That's the other... Mm-hmm. hurdle you have to overcome when you try to scale a program like this.
But I remember when my daughter was there and you had really cooperative teachers, that one of the reasons the teachers were so cooperative, in addition to the fact that it was super fun, was that they tested really well. They remembered stuff. They did well on their standardized tests in fifth grade.
Yeah, in 2002, there was a parent at the school who's a UCLA psychology professor, Jim Stigler, and he got the idea, let's test these kids after the summer, because typically kids forget 90% of what they learned over the summer.
Right.
So we went to Paul Revere after the fifth graders had graduated, and Jim and I and a history professor designed a test, and we gave it to all the Paul Revere students, because we figured that was a similar demographic from Marquez. And the Marquez kids blew away the other kids in American history. All the other subjects were the same.
Right, so that made all
science,
the teachers
they were
happy.
All on a parallel line, but the history.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that anybody can cram for a test, but the Marquez kids kept it with them throughout the summer, maybe because they're humming the songs or they'd been through it so many times, they knew what it was all about, and it wasn't just cramming for a test. It was something that stayed with them.
Exactly. I've had kids tell me, you know, they don't want to be sick on days when we rehearse, because they love school so much. They can't wait to start singing.
Yeah, and they loved it. People couldn't wait to get to fifth grade to be in the plays. It was really, really something that you look forward to. And I don't remember any teachers that weren't super jazzed about it, and the parents and the bake sales and the performance night and I mean it was just happy not still happy.
There's a little bit of a tinge of sadness in your voice.
It's been a challenge because there's a lot of politics on campus, and if somebody's breaking the traditional pedagogical model, there's usually pushback. There's usually resentment. Teachers, as a group, are generally a pretty rigid, controlling group of people. And when a teacher's doing something extraordinary, the tendency is, I think, to resent it, to feel insecure, to feel that you can't do that.
But that wasn't the case with you.
That wasn't the case when I first got there. But
and then you were tired.
So, yeah, Brooke brought up the R word. Why did you retire?
I wanted to do something else while I still had enough brain cells.
Go back to writing stuff like you did before you were a teacher?
I bet the yes. community was, the incoming fifth grade parents were apoplectic.
Well, that's why they hired me to come back and just do the three musicals.
Did the parents raise the money to pay you, or is
yes.
it? So
the Friends of Marquez,
Friends
the Booster
of Club. That's how much they wanted you to come back.
Yes, they didn't want to lose that program. That's a tradition now, 17
and
years of three shows.
When did you go back? Or like, did
I retired in 2016, and last year was my first year just doing the musicals.
And does the, you know, it seems like a legacy at Marquez, and we'll talk in a minute about what's happening with it now, but does the program die when you are no longer able to teach, or is there anybody that's going to carry the mantle after you're not teaching?
It's hard to say because other schools have bought the scripts and they're doing the shows without me. Schools across the country, I sell the scripts on a website. Teachers pay teachers. And I know that Michelle Kahn and Jillian Keller could do these shows by themselves. They might need a piano player. But
how are the shows at the other schools? Do they do well?
We've been to a few. Yeah, they do pretty well. I mean, they don't have the
LA star power.
They don't have the teachers there. Don't, with all modesty, I have to say they don't have my skill set because I'm able to stop a rehearsal and give a lecture, and so the kids really get a sense of what they're saying. Plus, I know how to build a number, musical number.
And being able to play the piano.
And play the piano.
And stop and not, you know, not have to go back to the beginning because you know what you're doing. You
right.
know, that's.
And also we have a choreographer, Jenny Mills, a local girl.
Oh, right, oh. right.
Ruth Mills'
She's
daughter.
Been
Ruth's
Ruth
daughter,
Mills'
yeah.
daughter. Jenny's been with me for 10 years. And that's another thing about the shows is the dancing. You know, we get fifth grade boys up there dancing. And in this age of childhood obesity, you know, you can't say enough about getting kids moving during a school day. It's remarkable. It's a great workout in addition to integrating history with the performing arts.
And boys with girls.
And boys with girls. Yeah, they love the love. I always try to have a love story.
Right. What was that song about along the... What was the
on river? The Delaware.
Yeah. Yeah. Anywho, so what's going on now? When did Miss, who was the principal back then?
Well, we had Miss Oda, then we had Mr. Dover, then we had Mr. Hollis. There's been quite a...
Why has there been so much turnover?
I think principals are reluctant to come all the way out here to the Palisades. And
they can't afford to live out here, probably.
Right.
And they don't. Yeah, one principal was commuting from Huntington Beach. And plus, it's a group of parents who can be a little challenging sometimes.
Because they're active and they're adamant and they want the best for their kids.
Right.
And sometimes maybe they step over boundaries.
Right. And they know people who are in positions of power in the school district.
They're tiger moms.
So some principals don't want to deal with that. And also the district tends to move principals after every 5 years. So that's the reason I think there's been so much turnover. Except Mr. Hollis left to make more money because he went to a school with more kids and more Title I kids.
That's good. I mean, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Phil Hollis and Jackie Oda were the two people who really got behind the program. And
now there's some problems with the program.
There are. Not with the program.
Not with the program, but the way it's
being
implemented.
With the support the program is getting from the administration.
Why is that?
You would have to talk to the principal to get his reasons for trying to downgrade the program. He would like to cut the third show because he says it's not part of the curriculum when in fact it is.
Water and Power?
Yes.
Okay.
He actually told me he thinks the kids sing too much, so I'm not sure if that means he wants them sitting in front of computers or doing worksheets. I've never really gotten an explanation about why he's doing the things he's doing, but we're trying to work with him.
How do the parents feel?
The parents would like all three shows to continue, and so it looks like we might be headed for some kind of a mediation.
Or, not to be punished, a showdown. Sorry.
And what about the other teachers?
Well, my two colleagues are certainly gung-ho about wanting to do three shows.
Have you gotten much pushback from other teachers for whatever reasons that they don't want it to be as prevalent as it is?
Well, as I said before, I think any time you push the envelope or do something that's not in the teacher manual, you're going to be resented.
And maybe it's somewhat threatening to them because you're stepping out doing something creative that's popular, and maybe it makes them look in the mirror and say, I'm just doing what's in the manual, and maybe that's threatening.
Yes, and it probably didn't help that I've been on the news and that I've been given awards.
But, I mean, you, as far as pushing the envelope, you started pushing that envelope 17 years ago. It's not a new envelope.
I did. I was working with some teachers who were more comfortable in their own skins, very secure with themselves. Older teachers had been around, like Ms. Heller.
But doesn't it also come somewhat from the top? If you've got a principal that says, this is great, we're doing it, we're supporting you 100%, then it's hard for the teachers to say, I'm not so much in favor of it. Whereas
exactly.
If you're getting a perceived lack of support from the top, it's easier for them to kind of step out and
right.
say,
and
I don't like it.
Right, and when my kid was there, the principal was just so proud of the program and would invite really important, like the mayor, to come and see it. I mean, it was a point of honor to have this work in your school.
Yes, you would think that any principal would welcome a performing arts program, especially in these days when all the arts are being cut. And we had Nick Melvoin, our new school board member, at one of the performances of Miracle. One of the parents invited him. So it looks like he's a big fan of the program now. So
I would think so. I can't imagine how you could
Nick
see
is awesome.
It. I can't imagine how a parent or any outsider could see that and not see it as a totally positive situation.
Yeah, no, it's baffling to me why we're meeting any kind of resistance at all. You would think this program should be embraced and protected.
And it costs about 4 cents. You could take this program to a fifth grade that had no arts budget and give them one rickety piano or a keyboard and one teacher that could play piano and you know, teach history, and you're done.
That's right. It's very user-friendly in that way.
I mean, you don't need fancy, there's no fancy dance shoes, you don't need leotards, you don't need fancy sets, and what you do have, the parents can easily do.
Oh, it's peanuts. It's a very low budget operation, and the best thing is the labor's free.
So and don't you sell tickets?
Donations, not sell. Yeah.
So
you're not allowed to
charge
for this public
school.
I mean,
in the work of Young Angels, one of the things that we did was go into schools and teach them how to fundraise. And it seems like something like this would be a way that a school could fundraise.
Oh, absolutely. And also, people put ads in the programs, which is another way, bake sale. It's another fundraiser. The program is self-sustaining.
So I'm baffled by one aspect of this conversation. When my kids were there, the Parents Association, I forget what they called it, but the Palisades, the Marquez Booster Club, whatever.
Friends
it was
of Marquez.
Friends of Marquez, thank you.
Bomb.
They were active. I mean, they were involved. They were, you know, if anybody wanted to do anything, they had to review it. Anytime they hired a teacher, they put them through the... ran up through the gauntlet. Why isn't Friends of Marquez sticking up for this program?
Well, I think they're doing everything they can. when you're not getting the support you hoped from the top, then you have to figure out how to deal with that. Where are the levers of power? What can you do at a public school when the principal's in charge and you're a parent at that school? How much power do you have? That's what we're finding out right now.
Yeah, I don't like tangling with principals. It's hard to go around them.
Well, we'll see, because
it's a fierce parent body over there.
What's next on the agenda for this issue?
Well, we're going to do Hello Louisiana. That's been approved, although we had to fight for the dates because the principal wanted to put a gap between the two shows so that we wouldn't have time to do Water and Power. We resisted that. So we're going to do Water and Power, and then two teachers are going to continue. We're going to do Hello Louisiana in March, and then two of the teachers, Ms. Kahn and Ms. Keller, two fifth grade teachers, are going to do their own productions of Water and Power, and it remains to be seen whether the principal's going to open the auditorium for the rehearsals. So we could have a scene where students are going down to the auditorium and the principal is like George Wallace blocking the door at the University of Alabama.
When you say they're going to do it themselves, you're not going to be involved?
Well, he cut my salary for that show, so if I'm involved, it would be on a voluntary basis, which I'm willing to do, so they don't lose the show.
The principal is Mr.
Merritt.
Mr. Merritt.
Former teacher at Marquez,
yeah,
who I worked with in the
90s. I think Alicia had him in fourth grade, and we did the Sacramento trip.
We were thrilled when he was hired.
Yeah, he was.
Because we worked with him.
Super great fourth grade teacher.
And a lot of us are very surprised by the way it's played out.
And his position is it doesn't, you can't justify it by the time away from traditional schooling. Is that his rationale?
It would be interesting if you interviewed him on this subject.
Well, we may just do that.
That's a thought.
Because I don't want to speak for his motives.
But, I mean, certainly when...
But you don't like the results, regardless of the motives.
That's right.
Okay. When I was a mom in his classroom, a class mom, and we went to Sacramento, that was a big deal and required a lot of fundraising and time taken off of school and T-shirts made and flights booked and all of that. And he was very supportive of that. I'm surprised. We'll have to get Mr. Merritt in here and talk to him.
It would be interesting because I just remember from when my daughters were in those programs, they were thrilled about them. And I what you just said is one of my kids didn't get a very big part in the first one or the second one. It was a little down. And then said, but, oh, I got this great part in the second or third, whatever it was. I mean, it was like they were excited. They got to get out and sing and dance. And they talked about the Constitutional Convention. And they were jazzed.
And too, if you got like a big part in one of them, like if you're George Washington in one, it was a lot of work. So when you got to be like just a backup dancer in the next production, you were really, really happy because you could just, all you had to do is memorize the lyrics and dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is kids learn a lesson that you don't always get what you want. And your parent is not always going to be there to make sure you get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to deal with loss. And you also learn to plan ahead. Like, okay, I didn't get this part, but I'm gonna make sure I audition for that part in the next show. And third, you come to see the value of working at something over time. The gratification isn't instant. You know, the show's very ragged at the beginning, and you can't see it coming together. Even 3 weeks before, you're saying, "Oh God, we're not ready for this."
3 days before.
3 days before. And then it comes together and the kids realize, hey, we worked together. We pulled this thing off.
Didn't you take it to Broadway?
Yeah, in 2010, we were invited by the Festival of New American Musicals in New York to bring an entire cast to the Duke Theater on 42nd Street. So Michelle and I flew with 30 kids for a weekend, long weekend, and we did two performances of Water and Power on Broadway as part of the festival.
Wow.
And we've also been at the Geffen. No, not the Geffen. The Kirk Douglas and the Broad stage. We've done shows there.
I think you ought to hook up with Janet Adderley and do it with her and just get out of the school business altogether.
No, no.
Okay,
it's
okay.
Got to stay
bad
in school. So since we're getting there, we talked about what you've been doing for the last 20 years, and now you're not full-time. You're working part-time, Marquez. So what are you doing with the rest of your time, and where are you? Do you have plans on where you're headed?
I think that in addition to musicals, another great way to teach is with cartography. So I've developed a map-making business, I guess you could say, because so much of history requires you to see how the action actually unfolded. And the prime example of that is Paul Revere's ride. There's a time lock and a distance on that ride. You had to go from Boston to Concord, 18 miles. And if kids are not familiar with the geography there, how can they picture the scene with Revere, almost being arrested, then having to go up to Medford, then go to Lexington, and then getting arrested on the way to Concord? So I thought, okay, they need to see this story unfold. So I did all the research myself, and then I hired a cartographer, a professional cartographer, and we designed a map of Paul Revere's ride. And then, again, like the shows, that was so successful in the classroom that I did a second one on Washington's crossing of the Delaware. Another historical example where time and distance are critical, and you can just see the whole thing unfold. And then I did one on the Battle of Saratoga. All of the two of these are being sold in gift shops now in Boston and at Mount Vernon. And then I wrote a narrative to go along with the Paul Revere map, which I just sold to Charles Bridge Publishing. So I just spoke to my editor on Monday, and she gave me an hour of notes and an edit. So I'm doing the rewrite now.
Excellent.
So this book is going to get published?
Going to get published in the fall of 2019. We'll do a book signing over at Diesel Books.
Yay.
And maybe in the...
Maybe at the Paul Revere House.
Courtyard at Marquez.
Maybe at the courtyard at Marquez, yes.
I'm sure that when that happens, if you let us know, assuming we're still around, we'll put it out on our Palisades podcast.
Oh, thank
that
you.
You're having a book signing.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It's called Why Longfellow Lied.
Good title.
Because he got everything wrong in the poem, and yet the poem's a classic, and most kids know the poem but not the history.
And I remember one of my daughters memorized the whole darn thing.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, my God, she's just out there. I'd never read the whole thing, but she was, well, I got it, Dad, and here it is. And she just went on and on and on, and it's a really...
You know the beginning, though.
Let me think.
Can I tee it up for you?
Yeah. He's never
Listen, my
it.
Children.
For you shall hear
yes.
the midnight about the midnight
yes,
ride of Paul Revere.
See, it's right there.
Yeah, but I don't have the rest.
Can there be a better opening two lines?
Yeah. So, and then, so you're going to keep writing, keep hopefully producing your shows at Marquez and teaching in either directly or indirectly.
I hope.
Yeah.
Teaching and writing is a nice way to spend the day.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Because it's public and private. You have your private time alone at the desk staring at the blank page, but then you get out and... When I walk in the room,
the
kids are...
Stare at the blank faces of the children.
No, they're never blank.
Musical
they applaud when I walk in the room. It's like a rock star.
Yeah. I know. There's other stuff you my daughter learned in your classroom. I think she learned how to play bridge in your classroom.
Yes, play bridge. Not in the... Another thing that's not in the teacher manual.
That was before homeroom started, where they'd come to your classroom like half an hour before school started and wait for you to come in so they could hang out before the bell rang.
Yep, bridge and music are wonderful tools to have when you're learning math.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's you set a nice standard for how to retire successfully and productively. As one who's contemplating it, I'm thinking about, you know, how do I do that? So I don't want to play golf every day. I don't want to sit on the beach.
More podcasts, Steve.
Yes. We got to do them every day.
Every day.
Well, as long as you have something you want to get up, you're eager to get up for in the morning, that's
yeah.
the key.
Nice. That's great. Well, we have violated one of our cardinal rules by having you on.
40 minutes?
Well, going over that, but also we always said this was going to be for Palisades residents, and you are not, but...
No, it's not Palisades residents. It's people of importance in the Palisades.
Check
Arnie
the bylaws.
Wishnick doesn't live
check
in the Palisades
Check the bylaws,
either.
Brooke.
Arnie Wishnick doesn't live in
anyway,
the Palisades.
Anyway, we were willing to break the rules for
Mitchell
you.
Mitchell Butler doesn't live in the Palisades.
Okay, all
it's
right.
people that are involved in service to the community.
Okay. The bylaws Jeez. Are wrong. Anyway.
We don't have, we play by the
I feel like a resident because anytime I'm meeting at Vittorio's, I always run into somebody I know.
There you go.
Walking down the street, everybody's going to know you.
Hey, Vanessa got married. Vanessa Vittorio's.
Oh, okay.
Beautiful, you know, her Vanessa who owns Vittorio's got married.
It's good news. I didn't
yeah.
know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, are we about
Yeah, I think.
Oh, let
I,
me tell you one, just one
yeah.
quick
okay,
story
yeah.
about Vittorio's. I'm having dinner at Vittorio's. And I see someone at the next table looking at me, and she goes, "Jeff?" And I go, "Yes." It's Mary McDonnell.
Oh.
The Oscar-winning
actress.
Actress.
Yeah.
You know, her kid was in my class. Mm-hmm. So when you're Mary McDonnell's daughter's teacher, you get recognized by Mary. You don't have to recognize me. Mary
right.
at the restaurant.
At Vittorio's eating pizza.
right. Yeah, great.
Yeah, well, here's to Girls Night Out at Vittorio's and Vanessa, married lady, and I think that's it.
Yeah, Jeff, it's been a pleasure. It's great to catch up with you again, and I know you've left a lasting impression on my daughters and hundreds, if not thousands, of kids around this neighborhood. So thank you for all you've done, and thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So, get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.